When the United States walked away from the Iran nuclear deal just over a year ago, the waiting game began. On Monday, Tehran announced it had amassed a stockpile of low-enriched uranium above the threshold allowed in the defunct deal, a move Donald Trump called playing with fire.
No message to Iran. They know what they're doing. They know what they're playing with. And I think they're playing with fire. So no message to Iran whatsoever.
An escalating series of incidents. Oil tankers holed with missiles. A US spy drone shot down. An American cyber attack on an Iranian intelligence group. Have watchers on high alert.
I think they made a mistake. And I'm not just talking to the country made a mistake. I think that somebody under the command of that country made a big mistake. It could have been somebody who was loose and stupid that did it.
The US president even said he ordered retaliatory airstrikes on Iran last week, then changed his mind with 10 minutes to launch. At the G20 meeting in Osaka at the weekend, the Europeans wanted to restore the Obama-era deal that saw sanctions lifted on Iran in return for holding off on nuclear armament. Trump did not play. But after the summit, he did go to the Korean demilitarized zone and in extraordinary scenes skipped over into the North Korean territory with Kim Jong-un.
The North Korean leader, one of the world's most brutal dictators, warmly greeting the U.S. president.
My friend.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, he said. I never expected to meet you at this place.
There's a lot to cover in this episode in the wake of Scott Morrison's first G20. What is the state of the trade war? How hot is the Iran situation? What does it all mean for Australia? And where does Ivanka Trump fit into all of this? I'm Tori Maguire. This week on Please Explain, should we be bracing for an invitation to another coalition of the willing? To find out, we'll start with Chief Political Correspondent David Crowe, who was just back from the G20, and International Editor Peter Harcher. Later, I'll check in with US Correspondent Matt Knott, who can tell us all about Ivanka 2024. Peter Harcher and David Crowe, thanks so much for joining me again on Please Explain.
Great to be here,
Tori. Pleasure, Tori.
David, you have just come back from the G20. There was so many factors to pull out of that summit. But I wanted to start by asking you about Scott Morrison and how he went in that environment. It was his first big summit as Prime Minister. What was his posture like during this meeting with the world's most powerful leaders?
Well, he did well on two fronts. He had an agenda that he wanted to pursue going into that meeting. It wasn't an agenda at the heart of the G20, but he did get an outcome. And that was the issue of tackling the social media giants, coming up with a statement from all G20 leaders that Facebook and others have got to act faster to take down violent terrorist content from their social media platforms. Now, whether they do and how they actually respond in concrete terms to this statement is obviously a big question. But I think everybody needs to recognise that getting a joint statement from all the leaders of the G20 is not easy, especially when you're trying to tackle information flows on social media when the biggest member of the G20 is the United States and they have a constitutional protection for free speech. This wasn't an easy thing to get across the line with Donald Trump and others, but they did get there. And so I think that was a victory for Australia at the G20.
That must have given him a bit of confidence, David.
I think it has. And I think I don't think it's something to be lightly dismissed, because this was Scott Morrison's agenda after the Christchurch terrorist attacks. It's personal for him. It's one of the first initiatives for him at the G20 in his early tenure as Prime Minister. I think he'll come back to it. If we don't see Facebook in Australia acting on some of these things, Scott Morrison won't hesitate to go after them again, because I think it matters when a leader like this brings up something like this early in their time as Prime Minister. It starts to matter to him personally, and I don't think there's any way of looking at it other than as a success for Australia in general at the G20.
And how did he go walking that delicate tightrope between the two countries he's described as our biggest ally and our biggest customer, the US and China?
Oh, I think the contrast there was all in the body language. He had a very important working dinner with Donald Trump. There was speculation about why that was held. On the American side, they speculate that there was this window of opportunity in the Trump program where perhaps there'd been a meeting with Putin or perhaps Xi from China set up at that time. There'd been a cancellation, so they slotted Australia in. Maybe that happened. But the point was that on the US side, they had serious firepower from the cabinet. They had all the trade people there. They had defence, foreign affairs. They had the Secretary of State there, Mike Pompeo. They had the works on their side of the table. So that was a very serious working dinner. The contrast was with Scott Morrison's meeting with Xi Jinping from China. It was what's called a pull-aside at the G20. They had a brief chat and that's all they had. So we're still in a situation where there has not been a formal bilateral meeting between Morrison and Xi at all since Morrison became our Prime Minister. And going back further, there really hasn't been the level of interaction between the Australian government and the Chinese government that there is with the United States. So that's the contrast. It's a fairly clear contrast and it reflects Australia's alliance with the US.
Okay, Peter, you were on Please Explain 3 weeks ago, and since that episode, quite a lot of our loyal listeners have given me the feedback that they haven't slept very well since listening to that half-hour discussion.
I often have that effect on people, Tori.
Where we're headed, because in that episode we discussed at length the trade war and the potential for whether the trade war could escalate into something more aggressive. Post G20, what is the state of the US-China relationship this week?
Yeah, it's a good question. The this week emphasis, given the erratic nature, particularly of the US president and his behaviour and his moods. And we see the repeat of an old pattern there with Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, which is that when they're in the same room together, Donald Trump seems to like to get along and hostilities don't escalate and things seem pretty calm. And generally he will offer, or they will walk out of the room with some sort of truce, at least a temporary cessation of hostilities. And that's happened this time as well. But in between those brief truces, Trump consistently takes a confrontational line with China and increases the pressure on China. This is a pause in his announced schedule of tariff increases until he gets the outcome that he says he wants from the Chinese. And we can expect that that will probably resume, if anything, only because, I mean, so there are two, the two big factors here are whether it hurts the US economy and whether it hurts his political stocks. There's no question that it does hurt the economy. But when Trump looks at the US stock market, which has gone to yet another record high, he can't see a compelling argument that there is an economic damage to the US economy. So that's a wash, if you like. On the other one, on his political stocks, it works for him. Getting rough with China, punching the Chinese in the nose, leading what has turned into a national cheer squad of anti-Chinese rhetoric has turned out to be a big political plus for him. The Democrats, not only do they not oppose him on this stuff, the Democrats are joining in the cheer squad. So he figures it works well for him. So we can expect, I think, unless there's a dramatic change from the Chinese, unless they're prepared to accept a pretty dramatic loss of face and surrender to his agenda, I think we can expect this to continue.
So moving on to North Korea, David, during the G20 summit, was there any rumours or sense of what was about to happen when Donald Trump ended up leaving the summit and going to the demilitarised zone and meeting with Kim Jong-un and actually stepping over into North Korean territory? Did anyone see that coming?
People knew that he was going to South Korea immediately after the G20. That was part of his schedule, and so that was part of the story. But we didn't see in Osaka at the summit, we did not see North Korea figure strongly as a as an issue of debate. And then, of course, in the last stages of the summit, Donald Trump tweeted that he wanted to catch up with Kim Jong-un when he visited the DMZ. And everybody looked at that tweet and thought, well, as if that's going to happen. The really surprising thing was that Kim reacted in the way that he did to a simple tweet. Maybe there was more behind it. It's something that I don't know. I can't tell whether there were back-channel communications between the US and North Korea that then set that up. But it was typical Trump in an attention-seeking moment where he used Twitter, his favorite tool for communications and diplomacy, really, or lack thereof sometimes, to set up the meeting and then have that moment where he walked across the border with Kim. And there is that parallel with the Xi meeting, as Peter was just talking about. It all looked really friendly. We had this moment where Trump and Kim seemed to be defusing the tensions over North Korea and its missile program. The gap, of course, is what's happening in reality. Has there been any change in reality to the nuclear program in North Korea? Well, no, not really. You could say that there was a de-escalation of tension, but that's about it. It's like buying time with Xi on trade, buying time with Kim on the nuclear program in North Korea. The optics looked good, but the detail is whether there's any change in policy by North Korea on its nuclear capability.
So while we are talking nuclear, that's a good time to move to Iran. Peter, can I just get you, for the benefit of our listeners who haven't been following this closely, to give us a bit of a background on the Iran nuclear deal as it was done during the Obama administration and what has happened to it since then?
The Obama administration took advantage of a particular opportunity where it was able to get the major European powers to agree, but with a greater degree of difficulty, the Russians and the Chinese also, to come in on a joint negotiation with the Iranians, where the Iranians, whose economy had been suffering, you know, a long and hard time because of the international trade sanctions imposed on it over its nuclear program, agreed to a pretty eye-wateringly tight regimen of constraints on its nuclear program. And that agreement, the Joint Comprehensive JCP Plan of Action, JCPOA, that's a bit of a mouthful, that meant that the Iranians needed to destroy their heavy water nuclear reactor, to put aside their stockpile of enriched uranium. They went from having 11 and a half tons of enriched uranium, now they have 300 kilograms, for example. And they had to conduct a whole range of other constraints, put a whole load of other constraints on their processes, and submit to regular and full inspections by international inspectors, expert inspectors from the Atomic Energy Agency. So the Americans at the time thought that was a pretty good deal, and obviously so did the Europeans, the Brits, the Russians, and the Chinese. And the Iranians agreed to that, in return for which the Americans and everybody else eased sanctions. And the Iranian economy, after a long time looking like a barren landscape, suddenly started to flower. And they enjoyed a lot of investment, a lot of growth, and it was flourishing. Donald Trump took a different view. Unlike all the other signatories to that agreement, the US under Donald Trump withdrew from the agreement, and the other countries, the other signatories, have tried to keep it going together with the Iranians. It's still limping along. The agreement still exists on paper. It was enshrined in a UN Security Council resolution. But without the US as a participant, with the US putting not only new sanctions, but aggressively increasing the range and nature of those sanctions almost month by month, we see a very troubling state of hostilities now between the US and Iran. We see the other countries trying to talk the situation down, the other signatories to the deal, but without any real success. And that's in a nutshell, where things stand now.
I know it's very hard to explain the motivations of Donald Trump, but why? What was his particular objection to this deal? I mean, the Israeli president, Benjamin Netanyahu, hates it and is very vocal. Is it his influence?
It is partly the influence of the two main US allies in the region. One is Israel, which, as you say, has been urging the US for years, was opposed to the nuclear deal with Iran and has been urging the US to get tougher with Iran for years, but also Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have been another big influence on this thinking. And because of the outsized influence of Israel in particular within the Republican Party in the US, it's also got a fair amount of support and an increasing amount of support over time with the mainstream Republican Party in the US. The logic, according to Trump, so that Trump has given two reasons for why he's withdrawn from the deal. One makes sense, the other is not accurate. The one that makes sense is that he says simply, I want a tougher deal. That deal wasn't tough enough. I don't just want a deal to constrain his nuclear program. I want a deal that where the Iranians agree to stop their other pernicious activities on other fronts. For example, the Iranians support, bankroll armed groups, political groups around the world, such as Hamas, Hezbollah, terrorist organizations. They support the Houthi rebels in the civil war in Yemen, where the Saudis are on the other side of that civil war. Trump wants them to cease all of that and more, their overseas proxy activities, their destabilization. Now, that is a real thing, and that is his stated goal. That is a real problem of Iranian behavior. It goes well beyond anything that the nuclear deal ever attempted. The second thing Trump says is the Iranians were not keeping their promise on the nuclear deal. Therefore, the whole deal wasn't working. Therefore, we have to scrap it. Now, that is objectively, according to the international inspectors and according to every other government, including the US government, until the day Trump changed the policy, that's not true. The deal was holding. The Iranians were meeting all the requirements, and the international inspectors routinely and regularly attested that that was the case. So they were keeping to the deal, and that's just simply a fiction that they weren't. But that's Trump's logic.
David, did this issue feature heavily at G20 or did it get lost amongst trade war issues?
Trade war was obviously the biggest issue at the G20, but there was discussion about Iran. And it is an area where, because the working dinner was held between Scott Morrison and Donald Trump, it's a logical subject of discussion. Now, Scott Morrison says there was no request made of Australia regarding Iran in that working dinner. But he also says that he shares the concern that Donald Trump has got with Iran over this nuclear agreement. Now, the history here is that Scott Morrison launched a review of Australia's support for that agreement last year during the Wentworth by-election. That caused a furor at the time, along with that review of the Australian embassy in Israel. In December, Scott Morrison announced the result, which was that we would stick with our support for that agreement on Iran. However, his support seems to be tentative. He says there's no request from Donald Trump on what we would do, but we've got a whole bunch of things happening in that region, not least attacks on two oil tankers that were, well, the suggestion is that Iran has attacked two oil tankers in recent weeks.
The United States claims they have footage of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard planting the mines on those oil tankers.
Therefore, one of the questions that I put to Scott Morrison at the G20 was the Royal Australian Navy has been in that region in the past defending shipping against pirates. Would we have any role to play if we were to defend shipping more widely in that region? And his response was that there was no request from the United States on this kind of thing, but it's not unheard of for the Royal Australian Navy to have a role in those sorts of things. Now, that's a response that does not mean we're going to be dispatching forces anytime soon, but I think it is an area to watch. It is something that we want to watch because he's getting along very well with Donald Trump. It's logical to think that there'll be requests from the United States for Australian support. We don't yet know what form those requests may take, but I think it's an area where there's certainly going to be some cooperation between the United States and Australia at some point in some way. I mean, at the very least, last December, when Scott Morrison reasserted support for the Iran deal, he did talk about other measures to put more pressure on Iran.
I know it feels like an eon ago, but it was just a week ago before you all left for the G20 that Scott Morrison gave a big speech in Sydney about in advance of the G20, which was essentially the preface of it was calling for an easing of the trade war. But he really spelled out Australia's role in the Pacific, didn't he, during that speech, David? What do you think Scott Morrison's foreign affairs approach is going to be?
Judging by that speech, he wants to take a more assertive stance. He was fairly direct about some of the problems he has with China on trade, about their protectionism, about their intellectual property misuse or maybe theft. I can't remember exactly the word that he used to describe it, but he was fairly blunt about that. On the Australian side, they were very adamant. They were adamant that this was criticising the United States and China. It wasn't trying to take sides between them, but the optics of the G20 suggest he's getting along much better with Donald Trump than with the Chinese side. On the Pacific, I think he's very serious about a step up. And that's not just about China's role in the Pacific. When he talks about the Pacific being family, I think he means it. I mean, apart from anything else, you know, we know that he can relate to Pacific people on several levels, not least the strong Christianity in that part of the world. So I think that speech was just the start of him setting out his view on global affairs. He didn't have a strong position on these things when he became treasurer just 4 years ago. He didn't go to the first G20 that he could have done. As treasurer, he left that to Matthias Cormann. So we are seeing him step up on global affairs, and it's going to be very interesting in the second half of this year. We've got APEC in Chile in November. He's chosen to go to Vietnam in August. He's going to the Pacific Islands Forum also in August. So he's going to the G7 in France in August as well. So he's going to be more active on foreign policy, and the speech that he did just before the G20 is the first instalment of how he sets out that vision.
Peter, what's your observation about how Scott Morrison will conduct himself as Prime Minister? Because his campaign was very local, very domestic. It's interesting to watch him be quite this assertive, isn't it?
It is. It's fascinating to watch him growing and expanding into that part of the job that inevitably Prime Ministers have to do. I agree with David that he's picked up with energy and alacrity the so-called, what he himself has called the Pacific Step Up. It started under Turnbull, but Morrison has actually accelerated, which of course is an outgrowth of Australia's larger strategic problem. And the large strategic problem we have is that we are being confronted by a very large country, which happens to be our biggest trading partner in our region, in a game of strategic chess, where the Chinese trying to establish and deepen their influence through the Pacific, but also in a whole range of countries, including ours, and globally, through not just the trade system, but remember their Belt and Road Initiative, which they've now relaunched to make more user-friendly and less troubling, which is the biggest global infrastructure program that anybody has seen since the Roman Empire. So in that speech, how did Morrison deal with this? He said a couple of things. He did, as David said, side with the US complaint against China on its trade practices. He, however, took issue with Donald Trump's use of unilateral sanctions and said, no, we want this dispute settled, but not this way. We want it settled through the World Trade Organization. We realize the WTO rules are out of date. Let's update the WTO and please take your dispute into the WTO, China and America, to settle. Not going to happen. The two countries, this thing is well underway, and Trump has no interest in standing down to get a negotiation in the WTO. So it was a restatement of principle from Morrison. It's not a practical proposal in the short run. The other really important thing he said in that speech was he said, I will not let, speaking of the relationship with China, he talked about the positives of the relationship, but he used this line. He said, I will not let the problems and the negatives in the relationship dominate the relationship. And this is the critical point. And nowhere in the speech did he raise any of the bilateral problems that Australia has with China. The Huawei ban, the foreign interference stuff, the undeclared embargo, Chinese import embargo on Australian thermal coal. He mentioned none of those grievances. He put on a happy face and said, we're just going to pretend that everything's fine in our relationship with China. So this seems to be his formula for dealing with it, which is to conduct the substantive policy to constrain Chinese influence within Australia and in the Pacific, but not actually wave it in their faces, and in the meantime, to get on as well as he possibly can with Donald Trump.
Well, Peter, David, thank you so much for your time. Hopefully we haven't done anything to increase the anxiety levels in our listeners this week.
Oh, I think we've been positively reassuring.
Thanks, Tori.
See you, Tori.
Thank you. David Crowe is our chief political correspondent and Peter Harcher is international editor.
This is Kate McClymont, investigative journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald. Hundreds of stories every week are produced by me and my colleagues at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, keeping an eye on corruption and cronyism in politics, sport and business. And we couldn't do it without the support of our subscribers. For 50 cents a day, know you're contributing to great journalism. Search for Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald.
Ivanka Trump's role in the White House is at the same time confusing and bizarre. She is an unpaid advisor to the president and is often presented by the administration as a senior diplomat, despite having no experience in that area. This week, she was caught in an awkward moment with leaders at the G20. Matthew Knott is our US correspondent and has been following Ivanka's role in the White House as it evolves. Matt, Ivanka in the G20. I find it very difficult to get my head around the fact that we're actually talking about Ivanka Trump in the context of world diplomacy and potential presidential runs. What's your take on her position in the White House at the moment?
People have been having a lot of fun in the wake of the G20 meeting with Ivanka. A video went very much viral of her inserting herself into a conversation with French President Emmanuel Macron, a British President Theresa May, and the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde. And then Ivanka is in there trying to participate in this conversation with these powerful world leaders, and it has created a big conversation around, well, hold on, what is the role of the president's daughter in this administration, and why is she the one speaking to these global leaders rather than, say, the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor, people who are in the cabinet and have clearly articulated responsibilities? Instead, it's Ivanka, and there's been all types of memes going around of Ivanka popping up at key moments in history, like the Martin Luther King's Have a Dream speech. But that's all kind of fun and games on Twitter. But I think it has been useful to shine a spotlight on the unusual way this administration works and the hugely influential role both Ivanka and especially her husband, Jared Kushner, play as advisors to the president, probably more influential than senior cabinet officials.
They were in the meeting with Kim Jong-un at the demilitarized zone, weren't they?
Yes, she was there. Meanwhile, National Security Advisor John Bolton, who was a veteran of politics and policy, he was in the George W. Bush administration. He was in Mongolia at the time. So he was, while the historic moment of the US president and the North Korean leader was happening, the National Security Advisor was far away in Mongolia. And that's interesting because he's much more of a hawk on North Korea. He is not in favor of the diplomatic approach that Trump is taking. Meanwhile, Ivanka was there, someone who doesn't have any background, it has to be said, really any background in foreign policy making or international affairs.
So do you think that Trump's kind of reaching across the DMZ to Kim Jong-un is being driven perhaps by Ivanka and Jared, if Bolton is such a hawk?
Well, I think it really is Trump's love of the moment and his real investment in this personal relationship he has, particularly with Kim Jong-un. He has this with other leaders too. He's really puts a big emphasis on his relationship with Xi Jinping as much as he has opposition to China. I think that's very much driven by his own personal style, but they're definitely a part of this, what would you say, unorthodox way of policymaking. Jared Kushner has been put in charge of big, complex parts of foreign policy that would usually be given to the Secretary of State. He's been put in charge essentially of Middle East peace and bringing peace between Israel and Palestine.
And how's that going for him?
It hasn't been solved. It hasn't been solved yet. He's actually started releasing some of his plans in that area, and it was rejected by the Palestinians the moment it came out. You know, it's not a solution that is given to easy fixes, but he's been given this role because that's who the president trusts. And it doesn't apply equally to all the children, that has to be said. Some of the other children are running the business and are still very much supporters of his, but it's Ivanka and Jared who are official advisors in the administration.
There was an analysis piece in the Washington Post this week saying that if Donald Trump's sons were making any noises or hints about future presidential runs, everyone would be taking it really seriously. And, you know, it would be something that everyone would be examining. So in that light, we should be taking very seriously the hints that Ivanka might be considering a future presidential run. What do you think about that? Is it remotely possible? I suppose anything's possible now, isn't it?
I think he had previously floated her name, I believe, for ambassador to the United Nations. He really loves to highlight and give Ivanka a lot of prominence. I mean, even more so than Trump, the interesting thing about Jared and Ivanka, or Javanka, as they know, they seem to operate as one unit, exerting a lot of control within the White House and feuding with other members of the administration. But they were Democrats right up until the moment Trump came into politics and started running for president. They were moving in these elite New York circles in the social world of New York, which is very, very small, liberal and progressive. And this was the world that they came from. They were Democrats. So to actually see her take on an active role as a Republican politician would be amazing, because they're still seen as moderate forces really within the administration. They're not coming from a particularly conservative worldview, more of an opportunistic approach, you'd have to say.
So just on that viral moment, I know that it's really fun to laugh at that and the whole world has laughed at it, but I had this moment of sort of mild sympathy for her, because we've all been in that situation where we're trying to have our voice heard and people are just cutting us out. Do you think that there's any justification for someone like her being in a room like that, or is it just ridiculous?
No, I think it's always nice to have human sympathy for people. And look, it's not unprecedented to have family members involved in politics. Of course, Hillary Clinton took on a really active role in Bill Clinton's administration. She was put in charge of healthcare policy and she had an office in the West Wing. Now, you could say her resume at that stage of her life was much more politics circus to ban Ivanka's. I guess really in the end, nepotism isn't something we're in favor of in theory. If they achieve incredible results, if they achieve great things, if Jared Kushner delivers some amazing things to the Middle East and Ivanka gets great things done for childcare, is one of her big focuses, childcare policy, then you have to give them credit. I think they should be judged on the results of their labours at this point.
That is very generous. Thanks so much for your time, Matt.
No worries at all.
Matt Knott is our US correspondent. Thanks to our Please Explain guests this week, Peter Hartcher, David Crowe and Matthew Knott. As always, keep your topic suggestions coming through to the team via email. The address is in the show notes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Thanks to the team behind this week's episode. Our producer-editors David Escort, Rachel Dexter and Debbie Harrington. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.